Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hey everybody, you're about to listen to one of two year-end episodes featuring our host Renee Stubbs, as well as cultural attaché Andrea Pekovic. The two of them go deep on first the women of 2023 and then the men. We'll be posting them in the next couple of days, but I wanted to call your attention to our newsletter because those of you who are living in New York City have an incredible opportunity to come see us live. We're doing a live podcast and holiday market here in New York City. Check out our newsletter. We'll be announcing it. You can RSVP. There will be prizes. There will be giveaways. There will be guest appearances. And there will be an incredible holiday market where you can grab some racket stuff for the loved ones in your life. Our racket newsletter can be subscribed to at our website. Don't miss it. See you soon.
I really hope so. I think it would be a great value for Gucci, who needs a win like that in their house.
Ladies and gentlemen, joining me today on the pod is the one and only Andrea Pekovic, Petko, Andy. Do you have any other names?
I don't. Andrea is good for me. Petko is good for me. Andy is good for me. So whichever one you prefer. I am the Caitlin of today's show, although I think I will take the guest host role rather than the host role. I don't know. How is it with you guys? Do you separate or do you just...
Just go.
You just do co-hosts.
We just, we banter and we talk and it just ends up being bullshit, basically.
Okay.
That's
good.
Pretty much what we do,
which
is what you and I do on a regular basis.
Yeah, so now we just put it in front of microphones. I'm a little jittery from the coffees that we've had, and I'm very proud of us, Renee, because we are not actually just sitting down and bullshitting. We have made a list, we have made talking points, we have researched, and we are ready to go.
I know, this might be the first time that I've ever done any of that.
Really?
It's one of the things that Caitlin and I do is usually write down about five things, and then we just bullshit. But, you know, because of your German heritage now, certainly it doesn't come from your parents because they are not German born.
No.
But that part of you comes out in being organized, having lists.
Yes.
There's one thing I know about you, Petko, and for all of those listeners out there, if you go to dinner with Petko, I'm a very much an on-time person. I might come a minute or two earlier. I have a propensity to never be late because I hate people that are late. It really pisses me off because I think, what, your time's more important than mine? I always know that you, my friend, will be there on time.
Yeah, that's true.
So you're organized, you're on time, and now we have lists. So we're going to get into it. Petko and I are going to give a bit of a wrap-up of this year, even though there's still a men's tournament going on right now. Can you believe that?
It's too long, honestly. Like, I respect the men. I respect that they are playing for so long, but that's too long. They need to rest. They need to refuel. They need a proper off season. If you don't have a proper off season, you know it just as well, Renee, you get injured. And we see that more and more. You see these early injuries. We will maybe get into a few of these today, but you see these early injuries at the Australian Open, Indian Wells, Miami, and that didn't used to be the case because normally you have those 2 months, November, December, where you first wind down and then you slowly prepare your body for that grueling season. Tennis is maybe the only sport where the season lasts from January 1st way into this in November. It's a long season. You have to be ready for that. I think it's too long.
It's crazy. I mean, I've been saying this for years. I mean, the one thing the WTA does do right, a little bit better than the ATP, is finishing
earlier in the season. It's crazy to me. I mean, think about what Casper Ruud did. I think that really fucked him up last year when he kept playing. Remember, we play those exos with Nadal? Like, fine, he's like your idol and you want to go, and you probably paid him millions of dollars to go do all of that. But, you know, then he didn't play after the Australian Open. It's like he needed a break. I'm like, dude, you got to pick your schedule a little bit better, which is why I think Novak, for example, has been able to dominate the last few years. I mean, listen, the pandemic was not a friend to him. Let's face it, vaccines and all, and not being able to play like three or four Grand Slams that he should have played and probably would have won. But you know what? I think it's given him longevity, even more longevity, because he actually was resting his body for a period of that time. So I think it's randomly has helped him. I'm sure he'd probably like to have played.
But I do think that that's a really good point you're making. And I think that's why good coaching is so important. When we think of coaches, we think of what they do on court, the technical aspects they bring into a player's game, the tactical aspects. But I think what is forgotten, how important the fitness aspect is of it and how you schedule a season. Where do you play? Where do you peak? When do you wind down? All these things are just as important. That's why coaches with a lot of experience help, not only on the court, but also off the court. And I
even
think
agents can put their two cents in as well and maybe make their players not play an event because they're getting paid $50,000 and they're taking a cut of that.
Yeah.
But, I mean, look at Serena. Serena didn't play after the US Open for like, what, like 7 years or something? Later part of her career, she didn't even play the WTA finals. She was like, I'm done. After the US Open, she used to literally hang her rackets up for the year. Which a lot of people are like, oh, you weren't supporting the tour. I'm like, bitch, she was supporting the tour for like almost 20 years. Like, give me a break. If she wants to take 2 months off of competition, she can come back and win the Australian Open. Good for her. You know, and a lot of players are still obviously continue to play after the US Open because they wanted to make the championship, you know, WTA finals, and they wanted the money and helps her ranking. And Serena's like, my priority is to win Grand Slams. Yeah. So for me to go into the Australian Open being rested and then winning Wimbledon and everything else was my priority. And that's what Novak's doing right now. I mean, he didn't play anything after the US Open. He went and played, what, Shanghai or Beijing or Shanghai?
Yeah.
That's it. And then, he didn't play anything.
He played Paris
and then the
ATP Finals and Davis Cup.
Brilliant. That's what I would have done.
And that's why he won, I think, because many times you see it at the ATP Finals and the WTA Finals that the player who was the player of the season actually doesn't win the ATP or WTA Finals because they are so tired. Because the player who is the player of the season has played the most matches, right?
That is your theory.
That's my theory.
It is true in some ways, except the women's, because well, actually in both, because, you know, Novak did win the US Open and then he didn't win.
Last year he played more.
Yes.
And so he didn't end up winning the ATP Finals. And this year he took the big break and then he won the ATP Finals.
You are correct.
Yes. But let's get into it. Let's talk about Novak Djokovic, because he was part of what I consider to be the last competition of the year. But you corrected me with the extra tournament going on. Exactly. Davis Cup. We saw maybe the budding rivalry of 2024, Jannik Sinner against Novak Djokovic. How did you watch the Davis Cup finals? What were your thoughts on it? What were your feelings? Did you watch anything?
I watched every single day almost. I wake up in the morning and it was great to have tennis still on, to be quite frank. And obviously these great players playing against each other. And you and I both know playing for your country was the most meaningful thing for, I would say, both of us. I mean, I loved my Fed Cup, Billie Jean King Cup weeks. They were just so fun. And, you know, I remember Darren Cahill telling me, oh, no, he's going to play Davis Cup. I was like, damn, holy cow, good for him. And then also Novak, like, good for him to go and play. Both of them to go and play is incredible to me.
Yes.
Because that extra week or so is, as you know, so important.
Absolutely. I think this season, we have to stress as much as we can. Jannik Sinner and Novak Djokovic being there for their country this late in the year after having played so much. And I'm sure both of them want to make a splash at winning the Australian Open is absolutely incredible. And it just comes to show you how important it is for these players and that they are really sacrificing a piece of their recovery time in order to be there for their country. And you could see it in both their faces how much they wanted to win. Both Novak, who has won literally everything there is to win, and Jannik, both of them just were so determined in this third set to hang in there.
It was such a good match.
It was really good.
I mean, it's amazing to me that Jannik Sinner beat Novak in twice in the space of 2 weeks. That's phenomenal to be able to do first, because, you know, Novak's the greatest player of all time. But to beat him that way in such an incredibly important match to win Davis Cup. Neither of them had won Davis Cup. Mm-hmm. They both obviously meant the world to them because they went and played.
Well, Novak, Serbia won Davis Cup.
Oh, yeah, that's right. He did. Oh, so France, he's already done it. So, yeah. So for him to... And another reason for Novak to not play is he'd already done it. So I just give them, so as you said, so much credit to the both of them to go and do that and play like days after being in an ATP final. So I thought the Davis Cup was incredible. Wow, like the depth of Italian men's tennis. So far out. Like how good is that? But also it's kind of a little embarrassing when you think about the US. They've got 5 players, I think, inside the top 25 in the world, and they weren't even there.
Yeah, strange. Let's stay with that match just for a while. What did you think of the 3 match points? Novak, third set, 5-4, Jannik Sinner serving down la 40. What did you think of that? How did you watch it? Like, what were your thoughts?
Well, I thought the first one was his chance to win.
The weird slice, right?
Yeah, that was definitely the first point. He should have won that point if he was going to win it. And then the third one, even 40-30, like I thought he should have passed down the line with the backhand. I'm sure
he knows how to do that so well.
Oh, I'm surprised that he chose to go cross-court. And you and I both know that usually going cross-court is sort of the safer option. And so that surprised me a little bit because he did have the room down the line to hit the backhand down the line, but maybe he thought Jannik was going to cover the line, which most people should cover the line on a backhand.
If they have ever talked to you before, yes.
Yes, yes, in particular. But I thought it was very brave as well of Jannik to come in. He made actually a really good volley on that 30-40 point. It was sort of jammed him and he could have missed it. I mean, look, Novak missed a very, very, very makeable volley on set point in the first set that cost him the set. So, you know, look, it happened. Just thought it was incredible that he was able to... My thing about Jannik Sinner is that his composure is incredible. Like for a young guy, I know he probably is, you know, shitting himself inside like we all do, but his outward demeanor is so chill and so relaxed. And I am so pumped for these guys to play. Obviously, look, this is going to all change in the best of 5, right? Best of 3 is a different thing comparative to best of 5 because, and I've said this over and over again during the ATP finals, for example, when he beat him, it's like, look, if you could put him in a final or you play best of 5, to beat Novak is the most difficult thing to do in tennis. He proved that again this year by winning 3 Grand Slams, no big deal, and losing in an unbelievable final at Wimbledon. So I don't know, Jannik Sinner, I predicted, you know, a couple of weeks ago that I think he's ripe and ready to win a Grand Slam next year.
Yeah.
He's never made a final, but I still think he can do it.
I really hope so. I think it would be a great, great value for Gucci, who needs a win like that in their house after losing Harry Styles to Loewe, probably. We don't know, but we've seen him in Loewe a lot. So they need the win is what I'm saying.
They
need the win. I just wanted to get back to one more thing in the match, and then we can move on to Australia, your country, Renee, in the finals against Italy. What is really interesting to me, so in Germany, we football or soccer in the US is the biggest sport, and you have that a lot of times that a team is the better team for 80 minutes and then they get the counter in the back and they lose 0-1, right? And you're like, but this team was better for 85 minutes, and it felt like this a bit in that third set with Novak. He had so many chances. He was the better player. You felt like every moment he's going to break, this is it. And I think that's why he didn't take that much risk on those match points, because he felt like, I'm just a bit better. I don't need to go for that much. Yes. And that all credit to Jannik for stepping up. He really played incredible in all the important points, served a few big serves. And we know that Darren, I mean, you know it better, you're good friends with Darren, that he...
he's worked on it.
They were experimenting with that serve, with the foot position and trying things, which I respect so much, because Renee, you know how hard it is in the middle of a season to take a stroke and just change it completely and teeter around with it. And just teeter with it, try it out, and it shows how Jannik wants to become better, how much he wants to win a big tournament. And he knows that if he wants to beat the likes of Novak Djokovic and Carlos Alcaraz, he needs to have that serve. And so I have tremendous respect for that. But I just love just the atmosphere was crazy. All the teams, like, also I loved in the Serbian team, all the ex-players were there. Yeah. You know, you saw Bozoljac, Tipsarević, Troitski on the bench. And the same in the men's. Matteo Berrettini is injured. Yeah. He doesn't have to be there.
Yeah, he was there.
And all the teams were there standing. I get goosebumps when I think of it. It was one of my favorite competitions to play, the Billie Jean King Cup. And I'm just so glad, because it does elevate the Davis Cup when two of the best players in
Absolutely.
The world are playing it. Unfortunately, that is the case. And so I was just so glad to see that. And now I'm going to move on to the finals. Actually, Renee, as an Australian, did you fully root for the Aussies? Or did your little weak heart also have a single tear for Jannik Sinner and the Italian team?
I love Jannik. You know how I feel about him. I just think he's the great. He's such a good kid. He's so nice to everybody. He's just such a pleasure to be around on all occasions. As you said, he's tinkered around with the forehand, with the serve, and getting better and better at everything. But of course, I'm pulling for Australia to win the Davis Cup. We haven't won it for a while, and they were in the final again last year, where they probably felt like they could win last year against Canada. This year, I know that Alex Popperin will be regretting that match against Analdi. You're a big fan of Analdi, and as am I. He's a young player, and what a terrific effort from him. But you could see at the end, Alex Popperin really, he didn't play a good couple of last games, and he, in my opinion, match point personified the whole match, where he had a forehand and he just didn't go for it.
Yeah,
he kind of
think he tensed up, or you think he just hesitated?
There's no question.
Yeah,
that he got tight. You know, he's a pretty relaxed guy, but he did talk about how, you know, playing his first match there, it was the most nervous he's ever felt.
Oh, really interesting. Yeah.
And you and I both know it's very, very different feeling playing Davis Cup and Billie Jean King Cup. It's like you're shitting yourself out there, because you're playing for more than yourself for the first time. You know, you're playing for your country, you're playing for your teammates, and that you could tell on that forehand approach shot, he just didn't hit it, and he guided it, and Analdi just went whacked with the backhand down the line. And that was the match. I mean, because you think about Jannik Sinner, for example, when he was down those match points, he still went for it.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? He came in. I was like super proud to see him like come into the net and be aggressive. And Novak didn't hit the passing shot down the line. He went cross court. And so, yeah, so I was super proud of Alex, because he played such a good couple of matches, but it was a bummer because that was the win. Because then if it goes down to the doubles, I think our boys pull it out, actually, because I think,
better doubles.
Well, they have a good doubles team, you know, and not to say that Jannik Sinner and whoever he was going to play with.
What did you think of the, especially the Serbia versus Italy
doubles? The
Italians
were so much better.
But just because all of the players on the court were singles players playing doubles, so what did you think as a doubles specialist and expert? Like, how did you watch that one?
I thought that it was the difference in that match was the fact that the Italians were a lot more doubles oriented in the match. They were poaching a lot. They were serving and volleying. They were from time to time, they were playing I formation. They were really mixing it up. And in general, what they did much better than the Serbs is they were looking to poach. So they were actually trying to play doubles. They were trying to cut off the angles, work together. And that's why they won. And anyone out there that wants to teach someone how to play good doubles, you know, it's the one thing that I sort of critique these days, particularly women's doubles, is that it's kind of like just four singles players out there just rallying, and then they lob, and it's just like, oh my God, the way to win doubles still is to be the more present at the net, and it's to be the more aggressive at the net, because it's angles. It's, you know.
Especially with the deciding point and the champions tiebreak, I feel like the doubles teams that have patterns for those occasions that have a deciding point or
Absolutely.
A 10-point tiebreak, it always feels to me that they have the edge on the other teams mostly.
Exactly. And if you are able to poach and volley well, you're going to win most of those matches. It's just a fact, because, you know, if you got two players at the net and two on the baseline, the net players are all, if they're good volleyers, which is rare in women's tennis, they're going to win that rally. Like, what are you going to do? You can't hit through me. You know, I'm going to read where you're going with the ball.
Well, you can hit through me, but
well,
that's why I'm probably the one at the baseline, not the one at the net.
But if you learn to volley simply, just do simple volleys, you'll win a lot more. And then what are they going to do, lob you? As long as you can read the lob, you're done. Like, so everyone out there still wanting to do well in doubles, get to the net. And that's what the Italians did better. They were a more aggressive team. And I actually did talk to Darren about that. He said, yeah, we worked on it. We worked on his volleys and when to poach, how to move in doubles, just in case, you know. And it worked.
Nice.
And you could see that. So I thought, hey, listen, well done to the Italians. That's great.
Well done.
It's about
congratulations.
Time you started catching up to the women. They won like 10 in like 12 years.
Well, and Renee Yannick-Sinner, player of the Davis Cup or
absolutely.
MVP?
Oh, for MVP for him and for the women, as I gave it to the week before, to Leila Fernandez.
Yes.
Who was clutch in singles and doubles.
Let's move into the WTA. We want to do a year wrap-up of the top 10. So we are going to go through the top 10 players, first on the WTA tour and then on the ATP tour. And we will talk, not very long, hopefully, but we've already are so long. I thought this will take much shorter, but we just like to talk. That's embarrassing for us. Okay, it is a podcast. So in the podcast,
people talk.
So let's get into it. WTA year-end ranking. I have it in front of me. Number one player.
Iga Swiatek.
6 titles this year. 1 Grand Slam. 1 the WTA Finals. What did you make of her season?
You know, at the start of the year, I know that she was very aware of her winning streak from the year before. Mm. I know that she was putting a ton of pressure on herself. Mm. To have that same year and was a little bit sort of overwhelmed by it in some respects, I think. And you could see that on her face at the Australian Open, like losing in the semifinals,
fourth round. Yeah. She didn't have great results in the slam. I mean, great results. I would have signed her results in the other slams right away, right? Let's be clear. But for a number one player who won Roland Garros and won 6 titles this year, she lost in the fourth round of the Australian Open, lost in the fourth round of the US Open, and made the quarters in Wimbledon. So she...
For her standards as the number one player in the world and as the best player in the world, particularly with what she did the year before, it was not a great season at the slams. Mm. But she won the French Open again. She won the WTA Finals. And she finished the year quite well.
She
I think
did, yeah.
after having sort of a bit of a tough year, really, especially after Wimbledon through, US Open swing was not good. Mm. And then, you know, she lost in Tokyo early, caught super fast. And you're like, oh, shit, you know, what's going on here? Mm. And she looked vulnerable. Mm, she looked scared. She looked vulnerable. She looked like anyone who could hit the ball hard could sort of put her under some pressure. And then she turned it around. She won in China, in Beijing, and then won the WTA Finals in Cancun and looked unbelievable. Mm. Didn't look great in the first match. Won it, down like 5-2 in the first set, and then just swept everybody after that. So I think she is by far the favorite now going into the Australian Open. But I think what she did this year was a learning experience about how to handle the pressure of what you did the year before. Mm. And as we know...
Because she was the dominating player last
by
year.
By far.
Yeah.
So 37 match win streak. No one's done that since the year 2000 when Venus did it. I mean, that's... Think about that.
Mm.
Think about all the great players from 2000 to 2023.
Yeah.
That had not done that.
Mm.
So I think she put a lot of pressure on herself, and I think she learned a really big lesson about don't worry about what you did the year before.
Yeah.
Just go on the court and play tennis.
Mm.
Because when you play at your best, you're the best player in the world by far. So I think she probably this year was as hard as it was with the ups and the downs. I think she probably learned more about herself this year than she did last year. I think she realized what she could do, like what her capacity was.
Mm.
Last year. I think what she learned this year was, oh shit, okay, all right, I don't have to do that. If I don't win everything, I'm not gonna like go into oblivion. I'm not gonna die. Everything's gonna be okay. And then look what she did at the end of the year. So I think she learned a lot about herself this year, and I think she's gonna be even better next year.
So the one thing I will say, which is interesting to me to look at, the Grand Slam, except for Roland Garros, do play quicker than the rest of the tour. Australian Open plays quite quick. US Open plays quite quick. Wimbledon is on grass, so it's flat. So these are the courts and these are the players that tend to hurt Iga. And we move on to the number two player
isn't
in the world.
Isn't it funny before you go on? Isn't it funny that she won the US Open the year before and I thought the courts were faster last
year? That's why I wanted to move on to Aryna Sabalenka.
So she knows she can win on a hard court.
No, she can win. She can win. But that's why I wanted to move on to Aryna Sabalenka. The reason being, I do think that Aryna Sabalenka, and in the beginning of the year, and we will talk about her too, and in the beginning of the year, partly Rybakina too, they did close the gap a little bit.
Yeah.
Whereas in 2022, Iga was that much better that the surfaces didn't matter as much, right? But Sabalenka did close the gap. She took over the number one ranking at the US Open. She won three titles this year. What did you make of her season?
Yeah, I mean, listen, great. Like, I was courtside for that Australian Open final. Still one of the best matches I've seen.
That was insane.
In ever. I mean, just the ability of both of them to hit the shit out of the ball like they do and hit it in as much as they did.
Mm-hmm.
It was incredible. Like, when I first saw that, when I knew they were going to play in the final, I was like, ugh, this is going to be terrible.
Yeah,
final.
I
like,
thought so too. Honestly, I also thought it was going to be, but it was incredible.
I think it was whoever was in the semi. I always like to have big hitters against a counterpuncher because it just makes for such a better match. And I was like, ugh, this is going to be terrible. It's going to be no rallies. It's going to be so bad. And it was amazing just because they were both playing so well. So for me, the quality of that match is probably the best match I saw all year, on par. And I just thought, you know, her ability to be able to control the nerves on the serve, get that back in organized, she played great. You know, she had a great year when you think about it. And some people consider her player of the year.
Me?
You think she's player of the year?
I said that to you.
I mean, you could also give an equal player of the year to her and Iga in some respects.
Yeah, I mean, I honestly think the one thing that the WTA was lacking in the past few years was that rivalry, right? The defining rivalry. And by the rivalry, I don't necessarily mean between two players. Like, if we look at the men's tour, we had Rafa, Raja, Novak. That's not a rivalry between two players. It's like kind of a few players where you know...
And you throw a little Andy Murray in there.
Yes, but you will know they will end up playing each other in the semis.
And finals.
And you're excited about who's going to take it. And I think that was lacking. So I was so excited to see it in the beginning of the year, Sabalenka and Rybakina closing that gap and Sabalenka just breathing down Iga's neck. Because I agree with you. I think this year was very important for Iga. And I think we will see her next year having taken another step in the level of her play because of that. And I think if she had just continued to dominate. I think there is a danger to stagnate when you don't have somebody pushing you from the back. And I said the reason for me why Aryna Sabalenka is the player of the year or has a small edge over Iga Świątek, she could have won all four slams. She was up.
Coulda, woulda, shoulda.
I know. But she won the Australian Open. Had 5-2 in the third set against Mukova.
Don't you think that that's the match that just killed her?
It did. Until then, she was the leading...
She couldn't close a match after that.
Yes. Well, she was in number one in leading wins on the WTA Tour. She had won by far the most matches until then, and it did kind of break her.
Yeah.
But then again, semifinals Wimbledon, she should have won that match against Ons 2. She was up a set and had break points, multiple break points to go up a set and a break. The momentum was completely on her side. Lost that match. And the same thing happened in the final at the US Open where she was up a set and the momentum was completely on her side to beat Coco. I think the audience had something to do with it. We will talk about Coco. But in a different universe, Sabalenka has won the Grand Slam. There was a probable chance for her to do that. So that's why just the Grand Slam performances for me this year from her were absolutely stunning. And I think if she can just stay a bit calmer in those moments, in those big moments, she did it. She did do it. She won the Australian Open. It's not like she can.
That's what's weird to me is that
is
the Australian
weird.
Open.
Yeah,
because look, we all do this. We all learn what our breaking point is, right? And when it's positive and when it's a negative for us. And she saw what a positive was is that she kept her mind, her body, her crazy, all this shit together at the Australian Open final. If there was ever a time to lose it sometimes, it was there.
Mm.
I mean, even the first game where she double folded like twice in the first game and she started laughing. I was like, all right, she's a well-adjusted human being. But she played unbelievable. After that moment, she kept her shit together and finished that match off. You think she would have learned from that moment, but she didn't because every big match in the final, in the semis, or a final of a slam, she lost her mind.
Mm.
And so I was shocked by that. So if there's one thing that she can learn is that remember what you did at the Australian Open, you kept everything together, you weren't throwing... I mean, remember at the US Open when she threw a racket up to her,
her
player box and it didn't make it? And I'm courtside for that match in the semis and I'm like...
And
she should have lost that match.
I was 100% sure she's going to win the US Open because normally when you win a match like that where you're already out and you've lost your shit and you manage to turn it around on your inside and you win that, you're free, right? You just feel free. You turned around the lost match and I thought she's going to kill whoever is waiting in the finals. She didn't. Coco won in the end.
Yeah.
And let's move on to Coco, because I think we can talk about each and every player
for
25 minutes, but we do have a time restraint, I guess. So let's talk about Coco Gauff. And I think what I want to talk with you about her, she has 4 titles this year, had an up and down season, but then I think the breaking point was Wimbledon. Yeah, can you talk a little bit about that process of transformation for Coco Gauff? She lost in the first round.
I like that
Wimbledon.
You've turned into the interview. I like this.
I'm interested in your thoughts. I'm not like trying to play the interviewer here. I'm actually interested because we haven't talked about this in that detail. We talk about everything all the time, but not in this much detail. And I just wonder, was that maybe the most important loss of her career in a way?
It's sort of similar to Serena losing first round of the French Open.
Yeah.
To French player, what was her name? The glasses?
Virginie Razanov.
There you go. I think that match turned around Serena's career, and I think that this match turned around Coco's because she was out of there. She lost kind of early-ish in the doubles as well, so she left early, went back to Florida, and started training on hard court.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, got Brad Gilbert to help her out once Wimbledon was over and his ESPN duties were done. And I think that what it did to her is that he made her understand, I think, that your forehand is definitely dodgy, definitely needs to change in some respects, or we deal with it and we use all of what you've got going for you, which is your legs, quickest player on tour, you know, arguably, other than maybe Iga. Unbelievable backhand serve when it's going in is huge. Very difficult to break her.
Good at the net.
So good at the net. So everything she has going for her except the forehand. So, okay, let's not miss the forehand and let's improve everything else. Do you know what I mean? And that's what happened. I mean, her play at – I remember watching her at Washington because I was there courtside as an MC doing some stuff. And I remember thinking, oh, she's not making any errors on the forehand. Where do they go? There's nowhere to go. There's literally no weakness on the court. It's the same as Iga. There's no weakness. Unless you're pounding it to the forehand and she's a bit late, there's no weakness. Speed, serve, everything's good. So I just noticed a transformation in her confidence of not missing the forehand. And that's where the confidence comes from. So I think her not missing her forehand, then we saw what happened. She lost to Pegula. Jess just loves playing against Coco. I mean, I don't think she's lost to her. And then she goes and wins Cincinnati again, beats Iga for the first time. And I think Iga learned a lot from that loss because she hasn't lost to Coco since. She's beaten her twice quite comfortably. But I think she was prepared. She was like, oh, she's not going to miss the forehand anymore.
And sorry to interrupt you here. I just have to say how important, unless you're Novak Djokovic, who just is a dominating goat of, all time, goat of all time, greatest of all time, how important it is for you to win a slam that the stars align. Because if Iga... Yeah. doesn't play Ostapenko in the fourth round, Iga doesn't lose. Iga plays Coco. And I have to say, I don't think Coco beats her again after the Cincinnati win.
Yeah, I don't think so either.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
And then she's not the US Open champion and she's out in the quarters. We all say, great hard court season. When will she win her first slam? Probably at the French Open, right? That's all the pundits would have said after that. And that's why you can't stress enough how important draws are and why we look at it. So
and head-to-heads.
Head-to-heads, exactly. Like matchups.
It's all I take when I go into commentary. Mm-hmm. People are always like, oh, how do you know all this stuff? I said, I don't know anything. I just go into the commentary booth or sideline. And there's only one thing I want to know in the matchup. What's a head-to-head and on what surface? Mm. And that's all I care about. Mm. Everything else is based on what I'm viewing because that's my job as an analyst is to analyze what's happening on the court. I don't go in with lots of, you know, notes and things like that. I just go in. My job is to analyze what I'm seeing and I want to know what the head-to-head is on the surface that they're playing on. Because somebody could beat someone on clay five times and lose them on hard court. You're like, oh. This. Like I would never pick Iga Świątek over, you know, a confident Rybakina on a fast court.
Yeah.
Right? I would never pick Iga Świątek to lose to Rybakina on a clay court.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Yeah, like that's just sort of – now, that's not to say that they can't beat each other on those surfaces. Yeah, yeah, yeah. But
just the probability.
Yeah. Yes. So if someone says, okay, who's your favorite? Then I'll say, based on this court surface, I will say next.
Yeah, let's just – one more sentence to Pere Riba because I think Brett Gilbert had his moment. I think ESPN was milking how great of a coach he is and all those interactions. It was great. He's a great coach. I'm not saying he's not. He's a great coach. Obviously, he has the results.
He's a very good tennis mind.
He has a very good tennis mind, also, obviously, and he brought a new energy. But I know Pere Riba. I saw what he did with Qin Wen Zhang. I know that his way of working on the forehand worked for Qin Wen, and I know it has worked on Coco Gauff's as well. And I think a lot of credit goes to him.
Yep.
And he was forgotten for my taste, he was forgotten many times because he's done the training.
Yep.
He's done the training. Coco lost in Wimbledon, she was on the court with Pere Riba. Brett Gilbert came on the first day of Washington, D.C.
Yep. Yep.
And as I said, I'm not taking anything away from Brett, but I am saying Pere also had his way,
his
and he also had his footprint on it. And I think especially on the forehand, because I know the Spanish exercises they do with the fast hand, the accelerating of the wrist, the turning of the body, the using your legs. I know what they do. And I think it really helped her in making it safer and have more spin on it. So I just wanted to have a few sentences for Pere Riba and his work that he done as well.
He should go back to Qin Wen. She needs a coach.
Maybe, yeah. Okay, let's move on. Elena Rybakina, Renee, a weird season. She started incredibly. The first half of the season was insane. Finals of the Australian Open, won Indian Wells. And I wrote down, maybe the toughest Indian Wells draw anyone has ever had. Can you pull it up? Because we looked at it earlier and we were like, these are the players she beat.
Yeah, listen.
I think Kennan in the first round, former Grand Slam champion.
What a great start to the year she had. And frankly, starting to look like could be number one in the world. I'm trying to pull up
smart.
You know, starting to play some unbelievable tennis in the biggest of moments. And her game is so big. Serve is so big. Backhand is so good. Forehand is very predictable. Mm. I think that a lot of people started to pick on that and realize that it, you know, has a tendency to go across court 95% of the time. So people started to read that. But on a slower hard court, like Indian Wells, for example, wow, like what an incredible tournament she had there. Oh, why can't I pull it up? It's so weird.
Well, she won two titles this year, and then it started to go awry a little bit.
She lost in the finals of Miami, which was also a great tournament for her. And then in Indian Wells, she beat Sofia Kenin first round, Paula Badosa, Gracheva, Mukhova, Świątek, Sabalenka.
Yeah, crazy. That's an
insane
draw. She
beat the number, number one and two player in the world semis and finals to win the tournament, and you know, just to start
and
it off,
three
with
Grand Slam and three Grand Slam champions.
So a great year, but you know, her year was marred by sickness, by injuries, by all kinds of things. So I think for her, if she gets herself healthy and not sick, she will be certainly a player to watch. She is one of my favorites at the Australian Open, again, for making the finals. And anyone that goes
back
to a
tournament.
That
court just suits her, right?
Suits her, and the ball suits her. Yeah. So, look, I mean, hopefully her coach is not yelling at her too much down in Australia. And she's,
well, we know your thoughts on that. But what do you think, what is the... not what is the reason, we obviously can't look into her body, but do you think it's just because sometimes you see that with players who, because Rybakina hasn't played that many seasons
yet. She's
got
that shoulder tape on all the time too, and that worries me. Maybe, and a lot of it has to do with sometimes with the service motion.
Mm.
I don't know. I'm not in her camp. I know her fitness trainer, Zula, he was with Karolina Pliskova when I was with her, and he's fantastic.
Yeah.
Great guy. Mm. Great.
She has improved her footwork tremendously.
Yeah,
I think that's what
part
of of why she played so well this. Yeah.
I think that he's one of the best trainers. He was with Burdick for a long time. So he's used to really tall.
Yeah. Exactly. Like stiff the movers. Long legs. Yeah.
He does a great. He used to be in track and field. He was a really good track and field runner himself. So he's, you know, gotten these players to move better. So
yeah, she
know.
Looked more agile because she looked like she wasn't slow.
No.
Because when she gets running, she can run. Yeah. She's not slow, but yes, because she's so tall and has these long legs, sometimes it looks a little stiff, as you said, and she looks more agile. She definitely, in the beginning of the year, she looked very smooth, actually, how she was moving. So great job to him. I love when we shout out the little fitness indie train. Well, just the indie parts of a team that because everyone likes to focus on the big star in the team, the star coach or the star agent or whatever. So
no,
I like when we pick out those little ones. Renee Jess Pegula, the quarterfinal queen. Yes, the quarterfinal queen. What do you make of her year? She also had two titles, just as Rybakina, one big title, Montreal awesome. 1000 title, 1-6, 1-6-0 in that final against Samsonova. So yeah. Killed her.
Like, listen, Jess, great year, super consistent. She will get to a semi. We know that the Wimbledon match would have been absolutely heartbreaking, and I think she possibly could have won the tournament.
That's what I wanted to ask you, Renee. So she was in the quarters, 4-1 against Wondrushova, who ended up winning 4-1 up with break points or game points to go up 5-1. Yes. What does it do to you mentally? Like, did you fear for her that it could have broken her? I mean, she won Montreal afterwards, so clearly it hasn't. Yeah. But at that moment, right? Yeah. We are in that moment. We don't know what's going to happen. Were you worried, like, oh my God, this could break her? Because I was, in a sense.
No, because I think that she knows that she can do it. Mm-hmm. She just has to do it.
Right.
And it's just, oh, duh, push, duh. You're so smart, Renee.
See ball, hit ball.
No, I think that, you know, when you get into that position, you just say, all right, next time, don't fuck it up. Mm. You know what I mean? Like, next time you get in that position, put the pedal down.
So you think it's a helping lesson rather than a, oh my God, this is
Jess
never going to happen
to
me.
Jess is such a well-adjusted human being that I think that she takes those things and trust me, just like on Shabert, like that would have hurt. Mm. There's no question about it. And it would have damaged her.
Yeah.
But to come back and win Montreal and do it the way she did, beating Inga in the semis, you know, it's like, look, it was great for her to bounce back that quickly. But I think that now it's more about the mental thing of getting over a quarterfinal. Now it's not the same. I know I did it in doubles, like where I think I lost like six quarterfinals in a row, and then finally someone said, just look, they said detach from the outcome.
Yeah.
And I did, you know, and once I got through that quarterfinals, it was like, oh, okay, I'm good now.
Yeah.
And so I think she'll be good. I think she'll be tough to beat in Australia. She likes playing down there. And so I think she'll break through when she does. We can all shut up about it, you know. But look, she had a great year and super consistent and probably the most consistent player this year other than, you know.
Well, talking of breaking through, Renata, 6 on Jabeur. We have to talk about that Wimbledon. We have to talk about it. I was with you during that final while it was happening. We were watching it together. I know your firsthand thoughts. You don't have to go into full detail, but can you talk about what you think? You watched the warm-up. I don't know if you have talked about this on the podcast before.
Yeah, I have.
Before,
listen, she was a disaster. The warm-up, she was supposed to go on center court and hit because it was it was so windy that day, they closed the roof. And so they decided to, because of the possibility of rain, they were just going to play the final with the roof closed. And so Vondrousova, I went and warmed up too because I was supposed to play in the old farts final that day. And then whoever we were supposed to play against defaulted. And so I didn't end up playing, but I went and warmed up for like 10 minutes. I went and hit balls. It was so windy. Mm. It was a joke. Mm. And then who do I see walking over there to hit balls? Vondrousova. So I'm like, oh, she's going over to hit in this wind. Yeah. Like, it was like 40
on
miles.
Arangi?
Yeah. She was going over to Arangi to hit. And I was like, okay. And then I saw Ons Jabeur hitting and warming up on center court. So I was like, well, that's smart. She's hitting up on the court. They allowed her to hit on that court. But then she comes out in all black. I'm like, what the fuck are you doing? Everybody in the world knows you can't play on Wimbledon courts unless you're wearing all white, even in the warm-up. And even as a coach or even as a person on the court picking balls up, you've got to be in all white. She comes out in all black.
And this is not the first day. This is the final. She's been there for
knows.
3 weeks.
So one of the referees comes out and basically tells her you can't warm up. You've got to go and change. So there's no like getting around it. So she goes, runs off the court, comes back. She's in the worst mood. She has all white on. She's warm out. She's missing everything. Her coach is missing shit. He's like, looks stressed. The husband's picking up balls. He looks stressed. I saw them before the match. He looked like he was going to throw up. I'm like, guys. And this is the one thing, and this is nothing because I love her coach. I love her husband. I love Ons. But this is where you need someone around. Because if that had been me, if I'd been an advisor or a coach, I'd have been like, listen here. You're all good. You don't even need to warm up.
Yeah.
Okay? Just go in the gym and hit some, run on the treadmill for 20 minutes. You've played 2 fucking weeks of tennis. Mm. You know how to play on grass. You know, you've got 5 minutes to warm up on the court. Does it really matter? Does that half an hour make or break you to go on a court, right? It does mentally if you go out with a bad attitude. Mm. You can't win. My old coach used to say, you can't win the match grubs in warm up, but you can certainly help yourself lose it.
Mm.
And you know what? That resonated to me because she tore herself down in that final.
Mm.
She was getting the shits. He was missing balls. She was getting upset. She's had to go and change her clothes. And it transferred onto the court. And she was miserable on the practice court, on the match court. And that hurt her.
Mm.
And so when I see her play those matches and she subsequently at the US Open, same thing. I'm like, you're the Minister of Happiness. Isn't that your nickname?
Mm.
But yet on the court, you look like the Minister of Misery. So you, I would say
sometimes,
to her,
yeah.
I would say to her a lot of the times lately.
Well, I think I agree
don't
with you.
Don't you think she looks miserable on the court?
Well, sometimes, and this is what I think. I think when she plays her best tennis and when she wins, like in Charleston, she won. She came back from the injury. Everyone was worried she came back too early.
She did.
But she, so she had terrible Indian Wells, Miami. She was not fit, and then she kind of pulled it together in Charleston. And I was there and I watched her. And she had so much joy playing.
Right?
And that's the problem with, not the problem, that's great, but when that joy has been taken away from her, then it translates into anxiety, into nervousness, into rushing. And then, and that's the problem with players who are so, so, so talented, like Ons Jabeur, I was very one-dimensional. So, which is but it's in a way, it's easier, right? Because I knew what I had to do to win a match. It was that one thing.
Yeah.
And if I couldn't do it, I knew I was probably fucked. But I knew I had to have good depth, I need to move well, and I need to hit the ball. That's it. It's very easy. For somebody like Ons Jabeur, who can hit the slice, who can hit a drop shot, who
creativity.
Can... And but that can block you, right? Because she, and then when she's rushing, when she's nervous, when she's anxious, then she starts making wrong decisions, and then it hurts you that you have so many options because all those options come back to bite you. And it's like what they say about humans: their biggest strengths are most often also their biggest weaknesses. And I feel with Ons, you see it. Like, it's so obvious because the joy for tennis and for life that she has is also the thing that hurts her when it's gone. And the creativity that makes her different than all the other players is the one thing that comes back to bite her in the ass, because she all of a sudden hits drop shots from 5 feet behind the baseline on a quick shot.
But missing, just basic missing. And I see her reaction. It's just like, whatever. I'm like, what the fuck? I go, you do realize that when you're at your best and you're egging the crowd on and you're like, you know, fist pumping and you're doing your tweeners and all, that's you at your best. So I would have said to her that Wimbledon, I said, listen here, we're not going to hit any more balls. If you're going to act like this, we're going to walk off the court. I mean, I said that same thing to Serena before her second round. I walked up because she was hitting balls in the bottom of the net. She was getting the shits at her. Hitting partner wasn't getting the ball in the right place, and she was having just a moment. She was late to practice because of traffic. You know, and then those moments, you transfer, you go on the court, and you get angry because you're just stressed. And she was stressed. And so I just walked up and I said, listen, you can't win the match here, but you can certainly help yourself lose it. And she like was like, I'm just, you know, we had a moment, but it helped her because then you could tell that she sort of was like, okay. And she did. She practiced much better after that, but that's because Serena's a champion. So Serena knew, I probably am getting a little bit stressed and I am getting a little bit too hard on myself and everyone around me. And she was much better after that in the warm-up. She played great. That was when she beat Kontaveit. Yeah. But that's what I would have said to Ons. I would have called her the net and said, listen, none of this is important.
Mm.
None of it. What's important is that you're happy going on the court.
Mm.
You've played enough tennis. Like, you don't even need to warm up. Just hit a couple of serves. Like, I'll hit you some serves, rip a couple of returns, we're ready to go. But well, so that is something that I think that she needed. And we'll see how she does next
year. That's what I wanted to ask you, because we were talking about breaking through for Jess Pegula to the semifinals of the grants of the majors. Will Ons Jabeur break through and win a slam? What do you think, a major?
If she becomes the Minister of Happiness again. Yeah, she can. but she needs that. And if she doesn't, her attitude is not going to get her there.
Speaking of Wimbledon, one title, the only title of the season, 2023, Markéta Vondrousova. But it was a beautiful one, wasn't it? Because it was the Wimbledon title.
Listen, it's like if I could win one title in my life and I played 20 years on tour and they go, you only won one title? And I said, yep, you know which one? Wimbledon? I'd be pretty happy.
I mean, I have to say, incredible performance. It was not lucky. She beat incredible players. She played so well. And I have to say, yes, Ons didn't play her best, but Markéta made it so hard on her. She just didn't allow her. Because, you know, you can show up to a match and play a bad set and start, you know, your footwork is not working, but you can always find yourself back. But Markéta just didn't allow it. It was like every time you opened the door to come in, she just came there and shut the door. She just
shut the door.
She just shut the door, right? It was a great performance. I mean, we have to give it to her.
I mean, listen, when you look at when you look at the players that she beat, you know, as well, I mean, she beat Halep in the semis and, you know, arguably you could say, no, that was last year. I'm kidding. That was Onshuba. But listen, I think that was, not Onshuba. That was
Rybakina. She beat Svitolina.
She beat Svitolina. And, she, you know, look, I think the bottom line is Vondrousova knows that she probably got away with something with beating Jess Pegula. And I think she took advantage of that. And she
that's
said,
what I meant when we were money. Talking about Sabalenka when she turned that match against Madison Keys around. I was
different,
like,
different though, because Sabalenka had the pressure on her and she didn't have the crowd.
Right.
Whereas Vondrousova went in going, I'm playing against Ons, it'll be fun, whatever. She's not going to overpower me. It was creativity against creativity, drop shots against drop shots, great movers against great movers. What shot are they going to hit? So it was kind of a lot of fun to watch that match.
The biggest difference though, Renee, is the emotional control that Markéta is able to exude. Both matches, semifinals and the final, was just cool, calm and collected. She beat Svitolina, who had to really exert herself emotionally to get to that semifinals, played some incredible matches, Svitolina did, at that Wimbledon. And beat Świątek there, right? And so Vondrousova really won Wimbledon, not only with her skill of tennis. Obviously, you have to have a skill of tennis to win Wimbledon, to win on grass. But with that emotional stability, just cool, calm and collected. Fucking respect, man. I really was impressed by her.
Well, let's get to Mukhova, who is right behind her. And just I want to tag them in together because a year earlier they were in some challenger in the middle of nowhere.
Yeah, crazy.
Italy or somewhere. And they're like, what the fuck are we doing here? You know, they're like, look at us. We're playing some 50,000 in the middle of nowhere. And then both of them are in the top 10 now after an amazing year.
So yes, respectively, 7 and 8. Vondrousova 7, Mukhova 8. And Mukhova, now this is interesting, Renee. Would you take a season like hers? 0 titles, but final Roland Garros, final Cincinnati, semifinals US Open.
Yeah, I'd take her a year.
Right?
I'd take
Me
her
too.
It's unbelievable. I wouldn't take her over Vondrousova just because she won Wimbledon. But but I certainly, listen, unfortunately injured again, wrist at the end of the year, which is a nightmare injury for a tennis player. Just the constant injuries are just killing her career. She is, in my opinion, someone that is without question, I told her this 5 years ago, and you can ask her. I said, you should be in the top 10. What the fuck? You're so good. There's not a weakness in your game. You come forward. You've got a great serve, forehand, backhand, moves well.
Great athlete.
Great athlete. Great kid. Works hard. These injuries are killing her. And again, another fucking injury.
Well, I will give you my theory. You know how I love theories. I have observed the thing with players, with athletes, with colleagues that I've been next to for the past 20 years. When somebody has an injury very early on in their career, it seems to
keep
bothering them, not in the same place, but just I think as when you're still growing, and she had a big injury and she was 18, 19 years old, and you're still growing. You're still growing into your body. You're
so
still
you worried
changing.
About Alcaraz?
I am. Same with Rafa. Rafa had an injury very early on and he always had injuries. If you look at somebody like Djokovic, like Roger, Angie Kerber, for example, she was never injured.
Angie Kerber.
Well, And I think that I had tore my ACL when I was 18 years old at the Australian Open. And I always had problems because of it, because your body compensates, right? You're out for 9 months very early on. Your body is still growing and your body compensates. So I do think that if you're unlucky in the beginning of your career or while you're still growing with a big injury, it tends to come bite you back in the ass. But what a beauty in the game. Just like technical perfection.
My favorite player to watch.
I call her TBT. Textbook tennis, Mukova. So Mukova. Let's move on to a very bizarre one.
Maria Sakkari.
Number 9, Maria Sakkari. She has one title. She won Guadalajara, a 1000. She has, however, also 3 first round losses at Grand Slams.
I have a theory on that too.
Sorry?
So I have a theory with that too.
Well, okay, let's hear it.
So I interviewed her prior to the US Open because we have these great, you know, practice week for the US Open, and we get to talk to the players on the practice court, which is great because they have the mic on, they talk to us, they're a lot more open. You know how it is the week before the slams, you're a little bit more relaxed. Once the slam starts, you're like, I don't want to talk to anybody. So I interviewed her and I said something about, you know, you're coming back to a place you made the semis last year, you know, you've got good feelings here. I'm trying to be all positive. You know, what is it about the new balls? But, and I'm sort of throwing all these questions at her where it's a positive. First thing she said to me, she goes, yeah, but you know, I've lost 2 first rounds of Grand Slam. So, and I was like,
so it was
what?
In her mind.
I'm like, my first thought there was, what are you fucking, who cares? Mm. You don't talk about that. Mm. I mean, when you're a great player, sometimes you just make an excuse. Like, I didn't feel well. Yeah. I didn't play a great match that day, but hey, I'm back.
Even if you're an average player like me, I had a lot of excuses.
Yeah. I mean, we all have excuses, but I would have been like, yeah, I'm coming back to the US Open. I love these courts. I love the atmosphere. Mm. This is the place. I'm playing well. I've just made the finals of Washington. Mm.
She was playing well there.
I beat Pegula in the set. You know, all the things. I've finally found my form again. No, she's thinking about the first round exits out of Grand
Slams. So it was her head.
As soon as she said that, I went, oh my God, she's going to lose again. Because you're already planting that seed. So there's a little things, for example, that I don't know if it's me, but I'm very in touch with the emotional side of a player where I would be like, okay, we need to talk. If I was coaching, I'd be like, we need to talk about this. You're thinking about your first round losses. That means you're going into the first round here at the US Open worrying that you're going to lose again. And guess what? She lost first round of the US Open. I was like, I'm not surprised. So the mentality for her is, I would have slapped her and said, fucking don't worry about that. You made the semis here last year. Do you understand? You just made the finals of Washington. You're playing your best tennis of the year. We're going to win this tournament.
Right.
Not worrying about losing the first round. And she looks scared on the court.
I see that too. Is that the, so you would say, is it the mentality? Is it the tennis?
Sure.
Does she need to evolve the game? What do you, like, I know she's a player that frustrates you sometimes, like in the best possible way, because I think you really like her.
Oh, I love her.
And you want to do her, you want her to do well. Yeah. So, but I can feel your frustration sometimes with her. So is it, does the frustration come from her mentality, like that one that you just mentioned, or is it her game? What
It's a combination. It's a lot of the mentality. But for me also, I think she needs to work on her slice, right? Because it is such a weapon. And you know this, like
I've never played slices.
Would you say you had a textbook slice? No. Would you say when you used it, it was for a reason?
100%. Well, I used it. Mine was not pretty, but I used it because I didn't have a similar game to Sakkari, but I like to play forehand from the middle. I did not like to play forehand so much when you hit into my forehand.
Yeah.
So a slice was a great way to get that forehand from the middle or the backhand side, because it's really hard if you play cross court for a righty to hit it with their backhand down the line. So it's like a good tactical aspect of the game to get away from that forehand in the forehand side, right? Which I think Maria also doesn't like so much. Yeah. So I see what you're saying.
I want to see her get a slice backhand and play a little bit more like Ash Barty, right? She's never going to be Ash Barty, but because Maria's two-handed backhand is
so good.
So good. And it's much better than Ash's. But Ash's forehand was ridiculous. But Ash would slice the backhand to get forehands. Mm. And she would toy around with people because it's so hard to attack off a slice. I mean, Angerbeur, all the people that have really good slice backhands are doing great, right? And so because most of the women like the ball, like knee to I would say, waist level to be able to smash it, which is what they all hit the ball so flat. But these girls that can hit with spin and variety do very well. So for me, I would like to see her get better with her slice. She brings her left leg out way too early. There's little technical things that she could do better. And then I think that she can then play so much more freer and be more relaxed because she's playing with creativity rather than with intensity.
Well, Renee, this is becoming such a nerdy podcast.
No, you know what we're going to do? We're going to internally talk women today, and we may...
I'll make a second part, man. I think that's a good call.
We've got too much to talk about.
Yes, let's do that way, because I don't want to rush through the men, because I think there are a lot of great narratives on the ATP side too. It was a really exciting season overall, and let's do. I think that's
we'll
a really
a
good show. Yeah, we do a second part with the ATP top 10 and also with just like what narrative stood out to you. But I don't want to miss on the number 10 player who ended up in the top 10 in the world, Barbora Krejčíková. She had two titles, and Renee, we just talked about the craziest Indian Wells draw for Rybakina this year, but Barbora won Dubai, and that was a crazy, she beat number 3, number 2, number 1 player in the world, is that correct?
It was crazy. What do you always, you don't,
I'm sorry, I should have given you a sign, I'm just going to talk. She had a very strange season, so the Grand Slams this year, the major, she did not do well, but she did sneakily well in the end of the year specifically. Did you pull it up?
Yeah, I did pull it up. In Dubai, she beat Begu first round. Not a bad win. Begu, Kasatkina, Kvitova, Sabalenka, Pegula, Świątek to win the tournament.
That's crazy.
She beat the number 1, the number 3, and the number 2 player in the world. I should have said number 1, number 2, number 3. But I just
we know your mind works in mysterious ways.
She beat 1 in the final, 3 in the semis, and 2 in the quarters. But listen, and Kvitova, who had won a tournament not long after that in Miami. So, look, incredible tournament victory there. She's so up and down when she's on, as you know. She's so good.
Well,
when she's off, she's just off.
Well, I think I played her a few times. I never beat her. I think she's one of the... In my opinion, she should be up there with Świątek, Rybakina, Sabalenka, who are just a bit better than everyone else. However, what I will say, she relies so much on clean timing because she really almost hits half volleys because she takes the ball so early. If she tenses up a little bit, it tends to go way off, right? Because she hits it so clean and so early. Yeah. If you miss a bit there, or if you're not 100% fit, we saw she struggled with injuries. So if you're not standing there exactly precise, like a Swiss or German clockwork, then it goes, like she frames a lot of balls. I saw it with Angie Kerber at Fed Cup. It used to be, Billie Jean K Cup already, I think. They played each other and she had this tremendous season where she won the Roland Garros. And it was the first time she had played for her country and she was tight, like we all are. She was anxious and I've never seen her frame so many balls. Sorry. And that was the first time I was like, oh, I see why she can be so off, because she relies on hitting and taking the ball so early that when she's just a bit tense, it just goes way off, you know, because she doesn't let the balls ever drop. She always wants to take them
on
the rise, and
it's
so hard. Yeah, but that's why she hits so clean when she's on. She's a player that I would really like to see in the mix for the slams again, because I feel like she can trouble anyone. I just need her. I need her. I think she needs herself to just be that, you know, calm, collected self again and just relax the arm, because then she's so dangerous.
Yeah, well, you know what? If everyone had
I
it
love
easy,
to watch her play.
If everyone has it easy, they'd all be number one. You know,
that's exactly true. Renee, we are getting to the end of this podcast. People are sighing in relief because it has been hours, it has been days, it has been years. But is there anybody else you want to talk about, or maybe a tournament or a competition that stood out to you in the season that is not in the top 10? Do you have anybody?
Well, I mean, I did say that I really think I really got to give a lot of kudos to Leila Fernandez. Mm. I think she finished the year really well. She's had, talk about a tough couple of years.
Yes.
You know, when we think about Emma Raducanu being out, what they both did at the US Open. So I loved the fact that she was the catalyst for, you know, Canada winning Billie Jean King Cup. Well done. Singles and doubles. Unbelievable. She won a tournament. Like, she's just, she came under her own the last couple of months. So I give her a lot of credit. And so I want to just give a shout out to Layla Fernandez. Look out for her next year. I think she's back, got the confidence back, serves under control. Kin Wen Chang, we're going to see what she can do next year. The stuff that happened with Wim Fassett, I think, is bullshit. You know how I feel about that. So I think she's got a lot to prove next year. And I think she's going to be really good.
Yeah. And I do think that she will build, because I, the way she phrased her complaints about him was, in my mind, maybe it's just me projecting, but in my mind, there was like a slight fuck you.
Yeah.
You know, in between those lines.
Don't know how to say that
in
Chinese.
I think, yeah, sorry for these words, but I think that will give her a lot of resilience for next year.
Sure.
I think she will find a lot of drive in this.
She's like, got an inner, she's got an inner drive and an inner kind of fuck you about her. She's kind of like, and she's great for the sport. And I think it's fantastic. And I want to give a little shout out to Sophia Kennan as well. Got her ranking back up. She's just somebody that I really believe in. You know, she had that win against Coco first round of Wimbledon after qualifying.
Yeah,
can you imagine being a Grand Slam champion and going out and qualifying? But yeah, so those three players, two players coming back from sort of like injuries and lack of confidence, both great players in Kennan and Layla Fernandez and Kin Wen Chang, who's that next sort of rising star. I look forward to those three.
Nice. I love that you pick the young ones, and I will show my age and my recent retiree. I will pick two older ones, not old ones, obviously, but I want to pick two mamas and maybe take a look ahead at two mamas that are coming back at the Australian Open, Naomi Osaka and Angie Kerber. I'm very excited to see them back. I think this is going to be crazy interesting to see what kind of form they return
Imagine
into.
Imagine if they played in the first round.
That would be crazy. Craig Tiley, can you do something about that? No, I'm just kidding. So I wanted to shout out Elina Svitolina and Caroline Wozniacki, both with tremendous comebacks after having multiple babies, really. And just getting their bodies back in shape or never letting them out of shape. I think both are just such hard workers and so hard on themselves. And the way they were able to bounce back, I think it will raise a bit of pressure on Angie and Naomi, just because they bounced back so quickly. I feel like they both came out thinking, oh, we have time to return, and now they don't have that much time, because Caro and we know and Alina did it so quickly, and I think we all know how competitive tennis players are. And so did you have a favorite tournament, a competition on the WTA before we take this to an end?
I thought the WTA finals in Cancun was great.
Oh my god.
Let's not even get into that. We've already done a whole podcast on that. No, I mean, listen, there were some things this year of the WTA that were just lacking. You know how I feel. That trophy presentation in Madrid, still to me this day, it just pisses me off that we still didn't get a statement from them on that, by the way. I thought the Australian Open final was incredible. Hopefully we get another Australian Open like that again.
Pretty good Grand Slam finals, I have to say, except for that Wimbledon. It was like all three, said the Sabalenka, Rybakina, amazing. The Swiatek, Muchova, really good. And also the Sabalenka, Coco Gauff, it was
amazing.
Yeah, I mean, Sabalenka went off the rails a bit there in the end, but it was a great final. It was so exciting and so much tension in that final.
God.
So crazy. Actually really good finals on the Grand Slam side, taking out that Wimbledon final maybe.
Yeah, we had a great year on the WTA too, as far as, you know, just new faces again, people winning Grand Slams. We're just can't wait for next year on the WTA.
Well, and you will do with Caitlin, you will have a live recording, actually. So if you're in NYC in New York City and you want to see Renee Stubbs and Caitlin Thompson live in their full beauty, I'm good at cross promo. Pre-order my book.
Sadly, the fashionista here. Oh, have you finished your second book, by the way?
I have. It's coming out next year.
Oh, cool.
But it's not. It's you can't pre-order it. So I was just joking. But on the 17th, is it December?
Yeah, we're gonna. Yes, I think that's the date. But we'll
you will announce
we'll
it.
We'll announce it.
Well, and they will talk about what 2024 will bring. So that's why we didn't do that so much today.
Today we wrapped up the women for 2023, the top 10, and our expectations, and what we were happiest with through the year. I just want to thank you, Andy, for
thank
coming
you.
On today, and we're going to talk about the the men in the next podcast.
Yes.
With you, my favorite German.
Thank you very much. I love being your favorite German. That's my favorite role in life. And second part coming up with the ATP wrap-up of the top 10, how their seasons went, and who will be the next, I think, Prada model. We need a Prada model. We have Gucci. Now we need somebody doing Prada.
We've got Gucci.
Yes.
So now we need Prada.
These Italians with their fashion houses.
You want a discount on your Prada shoes next, don't you? Mm-hmm. Yeah, she's wearing them today. It took her 7 hours to figure out if she was going to buy them in Melbourne 2 years ago.
I'm such a cheap. You've worn them every
day
cheap.
Of your life. You are. Anyway, Andy, thanks for joining me today. Everyone, thanks for joining us. Hope you enjoyed it. See you next time.
Bye.
Bye.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.